Cynthia Kersey tells the following story in her book, Unstoppable. She says, I love the story of George Danzig. As a college student, George studied very hard and always late into the night, so late that he overslept one morning, arriving 20 minutes late for class. He quickly copied the two math problems on the board, assuming they were the homework assignment. It took him several days to work through the two problems, but finally he had a breakthrough and dropped the homework on the professor's desk the next day. Later, on a Sunday morning, George was awakened at 6 a.m. by an excited professor. Since George was late for class, he hadn't heard the professor announce that the two unsolvable equations on the board were mathematical mind teasers that even Einstein hadn't been able to answer. But George Danzig, working without any thoughts of limitation, had solved not one, but two problems that had stumped the mathematicians for thousands of years. Simply put, George solved the problems because he didn't know he couldn't. A story like that may cause us to be moved to admiration because of the degree of difficulty that was overcome by an individual who didn't have any preconceived notions that they couldn't overcome it. Let me ask you a question. What about an incident where an individual is confronted with a situation that not only seemingly was impossible to overcome, but one that is absolutely impossible outside of a divine intervention? This morning we're going to consider a situation where there is no way, that is, that there is no human way to explain how an ordinary teen beat the overwhelming odds stacked against him, except to conclude that an extraordinary God came through in response to the teen's unshakable faith. This is going to be no ordinary story that we look at today. I don't believe that God places his children in situations like the one that we're going to look at today very often. All right? But when he does, it is for an express purpose. And that purpose is to demonstrate beyond the shadow of a doubt that he is God and that he intends to move in unmistakably powerful ways. Now, although this case before us is highly unusual, it is still profitable for us to be instructed by it because it gives us insights into the person and character and work and mystery of God that we would not be able to glean on our own. The event before us is nothing short of a divine revelation, that is, a gracious unveiling of God. And it is my prayer that we will leave this place with a better understanding of who God is, not just for the sake of knowledge, but that it will cause us to live lives of worship that attract others to our awesome God. And so that's our goal today, that we will see God, that we will be changed. The ordinary teen playing the central role in the message today is a young man named Daniel. And a particular incident in Daniel's life is found in Daniel chapter 2. And like last week, we're not going to read every one of the verses in this chapter, but I'll call to your attention some of the verses that help us to understand God's message for us. But if you'd like to open up your Bibles there or navigate on your phone to Daniel chapter 2, you can see what this is all about. We're going to begin by considering the overwhelming odds that faced Daniel in this situation. And we can sum it, Daniel's plight, as concerning two individuals and a group of men. So there's three things that he is facing. The first individual is King Nebuchadnezzar. We read this in verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful king of his day. Later on in this chapter, Daniel even describes him as King of Kings, which simply means that there was no greater king in existence. We're told in the first chapter of Daniel that King Nebuchadnezzar wanted to quickly make his mark on history. And so during the first year of his reign, he began the deportation of leaders and other promising people of Jerusalem to Babylon. Daniel 2, verse 1, which we just read, then records an event that took place during Nebuchadnezzar's second year. We're told he had a troubling dream and he wanted to know its interpretation. And what we'll discover from the text is that Nebuchadnezzar, he's somewhat paranoid. And we'll also find out it's for good reasons that he is paranoid. So that's the first person. As the story unfolds, we meet a group of men that unintentionally put Daniel and everyone else regarded as a wise person in mortal danger. They're identified here in the New International Version as magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers. If you'll just look at verses 2 through 4 with me. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I've had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." Now, King Nebuchadnezzar had called these men in to seek relief from all that had troubled his mind. He knew that the dreams that he had, they were more than just dreams. He recognized that it was some kind of an omen or some kind of a communication from the gods. However, instead of following the normal protocol for dream interpretation, Nebuchadnezzar had decided beforehand that he was going to put these so-called wise men to the ultimate test. It was like this: if you really are who you purport to be, then you should be able to not only interpret my dream, but you should be able to tell me what my dream is. Obviously, the king has his doubts about these men. And as the story continues, we find out that his suspicions were well-founded, that they were just charlatans there. Well, the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, astrologers quickly recognized the gravity of their situation. And as we read this, the astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of a magician or enchanter or astrologer. Yes, you may be top dog, but Nebuchadnezzar, this is not how it works. Nobody can do that. They could not do what the king asked, and they believed that no one could do this, that it was a humanly impossible request. Well, they tried to stall for time. They hoped to convince him to change his mind and to tell them the content of the dream so that they could make up an interpretation that the king would feel good about. But when they saw that the king was not going to back down, they attempted to use reason with him and said, "What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods. And they do not live among humans." So their perspective on this is, no way, no one can do this. This takes a divine intervention to happen, and God just isn't here. Now listen to the king's response. This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. Their failure to meet Nebuchadnezzar's demand sealed their fate, and that of all the king's wise men, they were all faced with death. The other individual that Daniel had to face in his impossible predicament was the commander of the king's guard, a man named Arioch. Verse 14 tells us that he was given the task of carrying out the king's order to execute all of the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers, including Daniel and his friends. And Arioch understood that the penalty for not fulfilling the king's wishes was that it would fall on him, and he would face death. So this is the situation before Daniel. Now let's turn our attention to this ordinary teen named Daniel, and what do we know about him? Well, based on the clues found in this book of Daniel and comparisons with other historical documents, we can estimate that the date for the deportation by King Nebuchadnezzar from Jerusalem was about 605 BC. Now, to give you some historical perspective, that means this event took place about 420 years after David defeated Goliath. So this 400-year period has passed. We get a picture of what Daniel and his friends was like. We see many admirable qualities if we were to go back to chapter 1. There he is described as without physical defect, handsome, he had an aptitude for learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. So this is the cream of the crop here. Now, while Daniel may have possessed many desirable qualities and abilities, got to keep in mind the fact still remains that he was a captive in exile, and he had no inherent rights or privileges. He was a prisoner. He was a conquered foe. He was a teenager. And we know that because the word translated as young men back in chapter 1 refers to a young person between the ages of 12 and 15. And as we saw in Daniel chapter 1 or 2 verse 1, it states that this event took place during the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. That would be the second year of Daniel's captivity. And so this would place him in the middle of a three-year training period. So we can estimate that Daniel is somewhere between the ages of 13 and 16 years old. 13 to 16-year-old prisoner. In the face of impossible circumstances, because let's face it, who can possibly know another person's dream and interpret it? In the face of these impossible circumstances, Daniel displays unshakable faith. I want to remind you of the definition of unshakable faith I gave you last week. I said, unshakable faith is the natural byproduct of an abiding relationship with God. Unshakable faith is the natural byproduct of an abiding relationship with God. It just naturally flows from knowing Him. Let's look at Daniel's expression of unshakable faith here in verses 14 through 18. I'm not going to read them all, but that's where we're at, verse 14 to 18. When Daniel found out from Arioch what had happened, his first response was one of faith. What did he do? He believed that God would come through for him. He believed that God would not abandon him. Why? Because he had seen God work on his behalf in the past. That's what chapter 1 is all about. If you go back there, it was about the diet that was set before him. And he, instead of taking And doing what the king had said, he went on a different diet because that diet went against the laws and customs of the Jews. And because God had been faithful there, he fully expected that God would remain faithful in this situation as well. Kind of like David. And so what does he do? He asks Arioch for permission to meet with the king. Ready? I'm 13 to 16 years old. I am a prisoner, and I am asking to see the king. But he boldly approaches King Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful person on the planet. And what does he say to him? He assures him that he will be able to do what the king has asked. Please, it's important for us. I know we know how it all turns out. But you got to stop. And in this moment, remember that Daniel does not know how it's all going to turn out. But his faith in God gives him boldness to act as though it's already a done deal. And what does he do when he gets back from seeing the king? His next faith response is this. He told his friends about the situation, and he asked them to join him in prayer. Prayer, seeking God's face and his favor in this matter. He knew that the task was beyond his ability to perform. And if God doesn't step in, if God does not intervene, there's no hope. And he also knew he couldn't do this alone. He needed his friends to join him in this faith adventure. So he invites them in. And now I want all of us to notice something extremely important here. That is, Daniel never fretted about his situation. We don't read that anywhere, that he ever frets. We don't see that he's cooking up plan B in case plan A doesn't turn out right. Instead, he just continues steadfastly and calmly to trust in God. Daniel also recognized that his abilities were limited. There was only so much he could do. And knowing the thoughts or dreams of another person was not one of them. He never claimed to be able to do that. But he also knew that God is limitless. Daniel knew that God does reside among men, and that he knows the thoughts and dreams of everyone. So Daniel, with the support of his friends, has done everything humanly possible. He is at the end. And it is at this point that an extraordinary God steps in, and Daniel receives the impossible. I love the way that the writer of Daniel records how God shows up in just such matter-of-fact language there at the beginning of verse 19. He just says, "During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision." Daniel believed that God would come through for him, and he did. That same verse goes on to say that Daniel's first response was not to run to the king and tell him. Do you notice that? His first response is what? To praise the king of the universe. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven. As the story unfolds, we find that Daniel's faith is rewarded in several ways. First, God revealed the dream to him and its interpretation. It turned out to be a dream about the future, describing King Nebuchadnezzar's role and the fact that God would ultimately set up his own kingdom, which would supersede all other kingdoms forever. So this was a dream about the future. The second way that Daniel's faith was rewarded is that he was rescued And not only him, but his friends and all of the so-called wise men. So lives were spared. Thirdly, God caused the king to look favorably upon Daniel, even describing him as bowing down before him. And again, I want to remind you, this is a real historic fact. This is not just some, you know, story here that somebody made up. But here is the king who is greater than anything bowing before a slave. Kings don't bow before prisoners. They don't bow before teenage prisoners. And the king also granted Daniel his request that his friends be given prominent positions within the kingdom. And the final way that Daniel was rewarded for his faith was by causing King Nebuchadnezzar to recognize that Daniel's God is alone God. There is no other God. Look at the king's response there in verse 47. It said, the king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery. This king was undone by an extraordinary God. I'm going to call our attention to a couple of central issues found in this passage. The first, I want us to focus on God. And again, this is an extraordinary, unusual, unprecedented event. There's nothing like it in the Bible. But it reveals some things about God and who he is in some unmistakable ways. What are some things we can learn about God? First, we can learn that God and his power are limitless. It's limitless. Things that are impossible for us are not impossible for God. And truly, there is nothing that's too hard for him. Second thing we learn is that he can be trusted. He can be trusted. He is not a God who changes. He is not a God who is fickle. He is not a God who likes to play games with us and put us in situations just to mess with us and then to laugh at our expense. No. He is a God who can be trusted and is reliable. And the third thing we learn is that God is not distant. He is not distant. He's not off somewhere else, leaving us alone to try to figure out our life on our own. God is near. And guess what? He desires for us to know him. To know him intimately. To know him as a person, to recognize him as God, as the all-consuming God who is near and who cares. So those are some things we can learn about God. The other central issue in this passage concerns the life of faith. And these verses speak volumes to us on what the life of faith is really all about. And I see at least four things highlighted in these verses. The first is that the life of faith is based on a sure foundation. The life of faith is based on a sure foundation. I want to remind you of a truth you've probably heard lots of times. But that is, our faith is only as certain as the object of our faith. Our faith is only as trustworthy as the object that we place our faith in. You see, I can have faith in some rickety old ladder and I can start climbing up it, but when the rung breaks and I come crashing down, I can see that my faith was not placed in something very secure. Okay, but I'm not talking about putting our faith in some rickety old ladder, am I? I'm talking about putting our faith in the God of Daniel, a God who we just described a moment ago, who can be trusted, a God who is near, a God who cares, a God who is limitless. It's a sure foundation. But we got to balance that out with this truth, and that is the life of faith requires taking risks. See, faith is not safe. Faith is not comfortable. Sometimes we're put in situations where the only hope of our survival is for God to step in and to rescue us. If it hasn't happened to you yet, it probably will. It may not be as extreme as Daniel's experience, but you may recall Jesus said, "In this world, you will have trouble." But then he finished off and said, "But be of good cheer or have hope because I have overcome." Faith requires risks. However, I want you to understand that it is not God's purpose in putting us into these situations to cause us to fear or to cause us to doubt. Rather, we're placed in these situations to grow in our faith and our trust in Him. I mean, I want you to think about how can we learn true faith if we're never put into a position where the faith is tested. Until that point, it's just theory, isn't it? It's just an idea. I mean, how can we be sure if our faith is real if we never ever have to use it? If every step is clear, why do I need to trust? So, it requires risks. Third thing. The life of faith cannot be fully experienced without the support of like-minded people. That's, I think, one of the lessons that's hard for us to learn as Western, individualistic, pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of people to learn, to understand, even to embrace. We try so hard to make faith this personal matter. It's my personal faith, just me and Jesus. You see, the Bible and faith in the Bible is not very individualistic if you read it. And it's hard sometimes for us to grasp that because of the way our language is written. But so many of the things that talk about faith are written in the plural, meaning it takes all of us. The dominant biblical view of faith is this, is that it is a community experience. I mean, why do you think it is that Jesus surrounded himself with a select group of men and then took them on faith adventures? I can't think of any other good reason that they needed to be together to understand and to experience faith. Why does Jesus establish this new creation called the church? If we could just go off in our own direction by ourselves and grow in our faith apart from one another. Faith grows in community. And the Bible reminds us over and over again that we need each other. And that Jesus is more present when we are together than when we are separate, meaning that there is more function of God released among us. Final truth about the life of faith that I'd like for us to see is that it is important for us to give honor and praise to God for the things that he does for us. It's not our strength, friends. It's not our talent. It's not our ability. It's not our ingenuity. It's not dumb luck or anything else that comes from us, enables us to do the extraordinary. It is all about God, and he is worthy of our gratitude and service. I don't know what kinds of things that God may be testing each of us with right now. Maybe you find yourself in a situation that just doesn't make sense. And maybe you're questioning, why would God do this to me? Why would he put me in a situation like this? And this may be especially true for those who have been told that if you just put your trust in Jesus, everything's going to turn out all right and you won't have any troubles. If you just have enough faith, it'll all go away. So if you're having trouble, it must be a trouble with your faith. I want to tell you, it's not true. It's not scriptural. It has not been my experience. It has not been the experience of saints through the ages. If you need proof of what I'm saying, I encourage you again, open up your Bible and read about the lives of people of faith and what they went through. And you know what you'll see on those pages? You'll see that true, passionate followers of God end up in some of the worst circumstances. People following hard after God find themselves in some of the worst circumstances. And again, if you want a place where you can get a good overview of this, go to the end of Hebrews chapter 11. And you'll see what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people imprisoned, people going without food, sawn in two, rejected, stoned, persecuted. And all of these were listed in heroes of the faith. I recall old Asaph in Psalm 73 saying something like this: God, why is it that all these people around me who don't care about you seem to have it so easy, and yet I'm having such a hard time? Ever been there? I have. Then he has this experience with God in which he comes to realize that, well, he was looking at things from the wrong perspective. And a lot of times we find ourselves looking at things from the wrong perspective. I want to just say to you today, whatever circumstance you find yourself in, here's a step of faith that you need to take. I know we don't like people giving us oughts and needs and shoulds, but I'm going to give you one anyway. You need to believe this, that God has not led you astray. That God is not toying with you. That God is not against you. That God has not abandoned you. Hear me, not me, but hear the voice of the Spirit through me. It's not true. It's not. Believe that God, in his sovereignty, in his absolute control over things, is sovereign over your circumstances right now. whether it has to do with your children or your job or finances or health issues or whatever. God is still in control. And I want to encourage you to take Daniel's example and not try to make it on your own. More often than not, trying to do life on our own is oftentimes the reason that we find ourselves in the messes we're in to begin with. And it's the primary reason we stay in them so long. Try to figure out the way myself. We need to learn to rely on God, and we need to rely on one another. Listen to God's command again. He says this, carry each other's burdens, and in this way you fulfill the law of Christ. It's from Galatians chapter 6, verse 2. Of course, this means that we're going to have to let people in on what's happening in our lives so that they can carry our burdens. So this week, instead of getting mad at God, instead of saying, why do you keep doing this stuff to me? Instead of trying to do it on your own, which you were never meant to do, follow Daniel's example. What does he do? Go to the king, and not just any king, friends, the King of Kings and the God of Gods. Go to him and lay it down before him. Tell him how it is. He already knows. Don't hide. And then go to some trusted friends. Ask them to join you in whatever you're facing so they can bear the burden with you. And just a side note there, when you don't do that, you're keeping somebody from being able to fulfill the law of Christ. Don't do it. And then, without fear, believe that God is going to come through for you too. Amen.